This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 285 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This is a very interesting interview, not just because of the content, but also because of the content that we believe will be of interest to both of our shows, the Outlander podcast as well as the All Souls podcast. Outlander fans will quickly learn or realize that the bulk of the story of the book that we'll be talking about actually takes place in Scotland and has its ties in Scotland and Scottish legend. And for the All Souls, the Discovery of Witches fans, there is the elemental magic, the link to an older pagan culture, if you will. So that having been said, let's go on and to both of our amazing, wonderful sets of listeners, both audiences, we bring you our interview with author Kathleen Kaufman. Kathleen Kaufman is a native Coloradan and longtime resident of Los Angeles. Her prose has been praised by Kirkus Reviews as crisp, elegant, and genuinely chilling by Booklist. She's the author of The Tree Museum, The Laird Baylor, soon to be a feature film with Echo Lake Studios and director Nicholas Verso, and her most recent, Hag, which launched in October 2018. Kathleen is a monster enthusiast, Olympic-level insomniac, and aficionado of all things unsettling. When not writing, she can be found teaching literature and composition at Santa Monica College or hanging out with a good book. She lives in Los Angeles with her husband, son, terrier, and a pack of cats. So with that, we welcome Kathleen Kaufman to the Outlander podcast and the All Souls podcast.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I really have been excited to do this, and I'm excited to be here for both podcasts because I love both of these books so much.
Oh, that's so good. Okay, so let's, before we get into
that, just sounds like much more interesting.
Summer's like, uh-oh, Ginger's going to let go now. Okay, so before we get started, which I promised we were just about to until you let me have that. So us having you here is not so we could all wax poetic and insanely amazing about Diana Gabaldone or Deborah Harkness, but I know we could though.
Yeah.
Totally. Hello. Yeah.
Yeah.
But tell us how you found, when you found out about those series. I'm just curious. When did you first read or hear about those series?
So Outlander has been on my radar for quite a while. And I mean, I probably came to the party a little late on it, to be honest. But in the last like 5 years, I just got completely sucked into them. And I think it's the historical detail in Outlander that really gets me. I mean, I just absolutely love it. It's so completely flawless and so crisp, and it just absolutely immerses you in that world. And even if it wasn't, I mean, take out all the stuff that I love, all the time travel and the romance and everything, take out all of that. I would read it just as a historical background. I mean, it's just absolutely brilliant. And Deborah Harkness, oh my gosh. I got lost in Discovery of Witches. I actually found it a couple of summers ago. And then this last summer, and then I read all of the books like in one big monster sitting. And like, you know, my family didn't see me for a long time because I was like, leave me alone. I'm reading. I have stuff to do. It's very important.
I'm so jealous of that because I read the book when it came out and then I had to wait.
Yeah. Well, see, this is what happens when you're late to the party. It's true. You can just binge. Well, then this last summer, I had this absolutely incredible opportunity to be on a Comic-Con, San Diego Comic-Con panel with Deborah Harkness. And not just her. There was Nala Hopkinson and Andy Weir and Cass Morgan and Brendan Reichs. And I was the biggest fangirl on the crowd, like all these really cool, accomplished authors. And then I showed up with my bag of books and I was just like, I love you guys. Will you sign this stuff and take pictures with me? And they were so nice to me. It was really nice, but they truly are absolutely spectacular people. And Deborah Harkness is amazing.
Full disclosure, I was sitting in the front row with, I believe, Ginger during that panel. And I will never forget the moderator calling your book The Lard Belore. It made
He's
me
not the
like,
only one.
Pee my pants. That was the funniest thing I'd ever heard.
He's not the only one. You know, I gave him a number with that title. My publisher, I think, still calls it the wrong name sometimes. And, you know, you can't blame him. It's half my book is in Gaelic, and yeah, I can't hold anybody accountable for mispronouncing that. So,
you know, but I read so much historical fiction that I expect people to be able to read Laird and Baylor. It seemed pretty self-explanatory.
Well, you know, it's Gaelic, and everything in Gaelic, it looks like it should be pronounced one way, and then it's not. So,
but never lard, never lard.
Well, you actually gave us a nice segue because into the beginning of the interview proper, because that is actually how we found out about you. We were attending Comic-Con as we have the last 4 or 5 years. And this last year, it was kind of like, well, 2018 has jokingly and seriously been called the year of Deb. So much has come out with the TV show, her new book, and
right.
So much, like two of her books have come out, and it's just been, and then she owned Comic-Con. I mean, she had like 4 different things. it was crazy. And yeah. So we were doing our utmost to make sure, even if we couldn't both be there, to make sure we had one of us be at anything she was either leading or a part of. And that was how we found out about you.
That's so awesome.
Isn't that? It's like, it's synchronicity. It's just interesting how things connect. And so, and don't get me wrong, it was like, I'm sure the panel was great. It was very enjoyable, but it wasn't just like, because there were other, as you already mentioned, there were other authors. We were there for mm-hmm. Deb, but you mentioned all these other fabulous authors that were there. Right. But I can't speak for Summer. I had never heard of any of them, including yourself. And the reason that you stuck out to me, besides Deb, was because when you, either the moderator or yourself, mentioned your forthcoming books, and when they started describing it, and you or the moderator mentioned Hag, you had a copy up there, like, you know, standing, and you described briefly what it was about, and I was like, hot damn. You mentioned 2 words that I thought, like, are buzzwords, Scotland and magic.
Right.
And I thought, oh, crap, oh, crap. I said, not only would, of course, my first thought was, okay, our Outlander audience would eat this up. And then I was like, hold on a second. The All Souls audience would eat this up because of the magical connection. And I thought, you know, it may not be like, you know, we knew your book wasn't coming out till October, but, you know, like, let's not forget about this, write it down and revisit it, but let's see if we can make this happen. So I'm so glad that we were able to make it happen.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. Yeah, Comic-Con was a trip. I had never been to it, and I am actually surprised that I found the panel because I was just wandering around in circles for about a day.
There's so many people that if you don't have like a map in front of you, you'll just get whisked away with the crowd.
Oh, yeah.
Off to some place that you never knew existed.
Right? Right. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And it's kind of crazy. And I happen to have a friend there who goes every year, and he actually led me up to the room and was like, okay, all right, it's right here.
He's like, here's your snack. Here's your juice box. I'll be back in an hour.
Do not
get
move
on your
from
panel.
The spot.
Exactly.
Right. But yeah, I'm so glad that you guys found it. And I remember when I mentioned Hag, there was kind of an audible gasp from people in the audience. And I was like, awesome.
That's probably us.
Nice. That it was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it could have been others as well. But I'm number one. I'm nothing if not a little dramatic. So there's that. And Summer will back me up in that. And no, that's basically it. I'm nothing if not a little dramatic. So there you
She's
go.
She's like, that was it. That was the only thing I had to say. I'm dramatic.
That's it.
Move on.
Or And by dramatic, I don't mean necessarily over the top, although that can be it. Just in my expressions, I go to the utmost. You know what I mean?
Well, that's good. That's good.
Your bio mentions that you teach at Santa Monica College. So tell us a little bit about even though this goes a little bit further back, tell us a little bit about your upbringing, how or if, I'm guessing it was the case, how you were influenced by writers, by literature, maybe, you know, was writing or reading extremely, not only supported, but were you influenced by your family at all, or just things you read, by teachers? Tell us a little bit about how you developed.
Yeah, so, I mean, I grew up in Colorado and up in a little tiny mountain town outside of Manitou Springs. And I read all the time. I read everything. I mean, I read books that were way inappropriate for me at any given age, as one should. And I grew up with not just books and stories, and I read everything, but I think my favorite was fantasy, and it was ghost stories, and it was anything spooky and anything with monsters and anything, as I said, unsettling. An aficionado of all things unsettling. That was the best. But it wasn't just that, because I grew up with stories, and my family is obstinately Scottish. And God help you if you've ever had to spend any major holiday surrounded by them, because they're just obstinately Scottish. And I grew up with that tradition. I grew up with my mom's stories and my grandmother's stories and my aunt's stories. And I grew up with being surrounded by that history all the time. And I grew up being surrounded by all the Scottish drama, because like I said, every holiday they would really get into it over the most hilarious things looking back on it. But when I was a kid, it was just eye rolling. Right. So as I kind of moved away from home and went on to college and life and everything, all of these stories have been stuck in my head. But so take all of these stories and then back them up with a healthy fantasy background. And it was in the last few years, I think, that I sat down. It was after I'd written Laird Baylor, and I was thinking about what, you know, the next project was going to be and what I wanted to do. And I had always wanted to write something that honored where my mother came from and the kind of extraordinary that she is. Because a lot of the things that came out of Alice Grace's line in the book, all of her stories, weren't fiction. My mother is creepy. She's really has had really extraordinary things happen to her throughout her life. Now, you ask her about them, she's going to tell you she's totally ordinary. Everybody goes through this. You know, everybody sees stuff, right? I mean, it's just totally normal. So I grew up with it being also ordinary and commonplace, but I had really wanted to write something that captured her stories and the stories that had been told to me by my grandmother and my great-grandmother. Because at one point, I think I realized that I was the last one who knew all of this stuff. It was just me, right? I knew all of these stories, and what do you do with them, right? I can torture my son, but then he's going to have to go write his own book, right, at some point.
Or therapy, one of the two.
Or therapy, exactly. Right? Writing is cheaper.
For sure.
Yeah.
Especially if they pay you.
Exactly. Yay.
Right.
Backward therapy. So
profitable therapy.
Exactly. It's perfect. So I'd wanted to write something that shared the history that I came from, but also really celebrated kind of the culture of stories and storytelling that I had grown up with. So I don't know if that covers all of that.
I think it's a good, it gives us a good foundation. So in your path to where you are now, did you go to, after college, did you go to grad school? Did you study anything in order to be teach at the college level?
Yeah. So my education has been kind of a long meandering route.
Sounds familiar. I get it.
I have a degree in theater, which has been really useful. Totally should get one, everyone. But I have a degree in theater. It was fun. No, but I worked as a stage manager for a number of years in Denver. You don't need a degree to do that, though, as it turns out. No, in fact, I knew way less than the people who didn't have degrees, way less. And so I have a degree in theater. And then when I moved up, we moved to Denver, and I then went back to school. So I have another BA in English and education. I got my teaching license. And then when we moved out to California, I went to University of Southern California out here. And that's where I got my master's. But my master's is in education. So it's kind of funny because I'm surrounded by a lot of people with MFAs and degrees in various writing programs. And yeah, my education has primarily been in education. So while I have a strong English background, I feel really fortunate that I'm able to teach composition and literature and writing at Santa Monica College. It's been really fun. I love Santa Monica College. Everything there is, all the classes there are fantastic and the staff there is amazing. They have a lot of faculty at Santa Monica College that have really come from real life experience. And so I think they have a very rich selection of people there and just interesting experiences to draw from.
Well, it sounds like, as you mentioned earlier, that even though you are legitimately trained in teaching, in education, you have the, I almost said software. You don't have the software. Excuse me. My brain is a little, I am on easy meds. The hard meds come after this. it's called codeine. But not yet. You have the legitimate credentials, what anyone from the outside would say, okay, yeah, she's credentialed or has the right academic background, whatever that means, to teach these, to teach the methodology, how the teaching of whatever subject that is. But it sounds like what gave you the subject matter knowledge, not just the ability to be that teacher, to be that instructor, is your entire life. All of your reading, all of your, yes, other degrees, but all of your reading, your rich imagination, this palette from which you have chosen to read these things such as fantasy and you know, not things that are stuck in the real world, that has made your ability, and then of course ultimately as a writer, your ability to teach, to form stories more rich.
Oh, I like that.
You can take it. You can take it for free.
Oh. She's like, that's going on my next book cover.
I was going to say, I know who's writing my next bio.
And my voice will be, if you write a book that doesn't have a ton of accents in it, I'll narrate that as well. And I won't sound nice. Like this.
I like it. I like it. It's working for you. So, but I do tend to go with literature selections that are a little off kilter. And we're wrapping up my first bout of teaching English 2 at Santa Monica College. And we've had a blast. We've been reading Shirley Jackson and Octavia Butler and Tanana Reeve Due and Nala Hopkinson and Carmen Maria Machado. And like just some stories, and it's been an all female lineup of writers, and it's been an all either horror or Afrofuturism or fantasy lineup too of stories. And it's been a blast. I guess I'll see how my students feel about it after finals, but I have had so much fun. And I think they have too, because it's not books that you're exposed to in a traditional literature course, but it's just as legit. And I feel especially about Shirley Jackson. Her writing is so flawless and it's so impeccable. And I have never understood why it wasn't mainstream in all education courses when you're talking about literature and word choice and prose and construction. Why it hasn't been is a vast mystery to me. But yeah, I think all of my curriculum that I choose comes out of that tradition. We read a lot of Neil Gaiman in a lot of my classes, and I try to mix it up with authors who maybe have not made it into sort of the mainstream education curriculum. Because I feel like academia gets very mired down in classics, theoretical classics sometimes. And we ignore just so like this vast array of books and stories and traditions of storytelling. So one of my greatest compliments in this last semester, one of my students told me that, I'm not sure it was supposed to be a compliment, but they said that they couldn't just sit down and read for my class. They had to sit down and prepare themselves because they were going to be disturbed and they weren't going to be able to sleep. And I was like, thank you. They looked at me like that wasn't a compliment.
Oh, but yes, I'm like you know? I would take that as a compliment because that is what reading is supposed to do. Or sorry, not reading. That's what good writing is supposed to do.
Well, not only that, but I mean, we all kind of tittered a little bit when you said I have a theater degree. But you know what? I think that more professions could benefit from having people with theater degrees in them because I try almost every like business environment I've worked in. I'm like, we could really use an improv class. Everyone needs an improv class because life is improv. And I think that if people, because you get to like interview processes and people, you sit down and they're like, they don't know what to say. And I'm like, well, say something. I'm like, that's life. You always have to come up with something. And I'm like, there's always something that you can take from a theater class that you took years ago, just, or a movement class or something that will help you with almost all of the things you encounter in any other field. And I'm sure that it 100% helps you when you're getting in front of your class and trying to get them interested and involved with the story.
Oh, sure. And I laugh, but honestly, my husband and I both have theater degrees, and we've laughed about the fact that that probably has been the most valuable education if in terms of things that we use on a daily basis. The things that the experience that we garnered from it, and just the skill sets that we pulled out of our theater degrees, this probably been the most valuable because it's true. Every time you step up in front of a crowd, every time you find yourself having to improvise in any given situation, it's incredibly valuable. And I have a considerable degree of anxiety. So I don't have a lot of speaking in front of crowd type anxiety. It's funny. It's like the bigger the crowd, the less anxious I am. The smaller the crowd. But to know how to kind of turn that off and put on a different and make it through is a skill. And I owe that entirely to
the theater.
You know, to the theater. But to learn how to put on a face, to learn how to get through it. So yeah, it's been a really valuable thing. It's been a really valuable education. And so I can make fun of it all I want. I make fun because what I did in theater primarily was backstage stuff. I worked stage managing and building sets and hanging lights. And when I left college and I went into a professional theater, I realized how much I didn't know. I realized how lacking really like a formal education in that field had been, and at least in my case. So I said all the guys who had just kind of been doing it their whole lives were the ones who had to teach me how to do everything in theater. And I think that field kind of lends itself to practical experience as much as like a formal college degree does. And it's true with actors too. I mean, I think some of the best actors I've ever known were people who just had seriously interesting lives, and then they decided to get up on stage and express that. So, yeah, I can make fun of my theater degree all I want, but I probably used it more than anything else.
It's funny. So. It's not funny, haha, but it's interesting that you mentioned that you had the formal degree, and then you went out to a professional theater. You learned more, especially about the areas that you were working in. So the behind the scenes type of things, you learn more from the people who were professionals who maybe didn't even have a degree because they'd been doing it for years. And that just made me think, I know it's not our focus here at all, but that just made me think, and Summer, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe Kathleen, you know as well, but in New York, for example, on Broadway, it's just like one example, but especially as an easy example, because it's so well known, there are guild may not be the right term, but there are like unions for people who work in orchestras, right? There are unions for people who work backstage.
There are unions
doing certain
for ushers.
Exactly. There are so many things. And so the reason I'm saying this is not to get into a discussion about those, but it makes sense that if people are doing that for a lifetime, like that's their life's work, that's where they spend that's where they gain their knowledge on the job, or because they've been mentored by someone else. And that's like, you know, they may, I'm not going to make any judgment. I couldn't even guess if they have any formal education or college degree. That doesn't really matter, but they wouldn't necessarily need one to get into that line of work, you know? And so I find it fascinating that, it just made me think about that. So with your experience, you had the formal degree and then you went into the quote unquote in the real world and saw how much you did not know. And, but yet people are, you know, people spend their entire lives, 20, 30, 40 years were in unions just for that role or just for that job type. So I find that fascinating. So as you developed into who you are now, before you wrote your first, before you published your first work, first book, when did you know, or did you know when you were much younger, when did you know that you were a writer or you wanted to be a writer or that you wanted to start that journey?
Oh, so this is a good one. I, when I was in about third grade, I started, and I went to a very small school. So in my graduating class at the end of high school, we only had 40 kids in the whole class. And so my elementary school was, you know, cut that in half, you know, because we combined with another elementary school come around middle school. But anyhow, so I went to elementary with about the same 20 kids all through, and then, you know, the same 40 kids all through graduation. It was a little crazy. Small towns. But I used to, I started in about third grade, I would start writing stories that would take every single kid in my class and I would put them in some kind of fictional setting. It was usually horrific. There was usually zombies or mummies or horrible swamp monsters chasing us. A lot of people didn't make it out of the story. And I somehow convinced my teachers year after year to let me stand up and read these stories for everybody. And they loved it. They loved, you know, and especially they would like cheer when they got knocked off by the zombies or the swamp monsters, or this is called public education in the 1980s. But yeah, so I think I'd always been writing ever since I was a little kid, and it had always been scary stuff and it had always been kind of off kilter. And I had a real sense of wanting to do that for a living and wanting to do that for a career. And when I was working on my theater degree and in that field, one of the things I enjoyed most was writing. And I had an opportunity at the time to do a little bit of screenwriting, a little bit of stage writing. And that was, I think, one of the things I loved most, even in that world. Unfortunately, it's one of the hardest things to get into and be successful at in that world too, whether it's screenwriting or stage writing. But yeah, I think I'd had a sense from when I was really young that that was something I wanted to do and that it was something that I was good at, you know, in terms of being able to come up with ideas and being able to figure out characters. And but it's something that I always loved to do ever since I was a little tiny kid.
And as you began becoming more formal or more serious about your writing, going from, you know, stuff you've done for school or stuff you've done for maybe for a job, when did you start to formalize your interest or formalize your ideas of, okay, so I definitely am a writer. I'm going to do this. I'm going to die trying. But this is the type of thing that I love, or this is the type of thing I want to try. How did you hone in and decide that the kind of the magical fantasy genre was something that just that was the one for you?
Ooh, I don't know if I ever had a choice in it, to be honest. even when I was in classes and I was supposed to write something that was very different, it always ended up taking that route, and it definitely always walked the line between magical realism on the tamest end. And that was the biggest criticism. I remember taking a creative writing class when I was working on my education degree, and the creative writing class, I was in constant trouble with the writing teacher because I was supposed to write a very straight screenplay, you know, just like a script kind of thing. And all of a sudden there was a monster in it and things were happening. And I was in my 20s at the time, so I wasn't a kid. And he was like, you know better. Okay, you can read the assignment, right? I was like, yeah, but I mean, this, I'm sorry, that's what happened. I can't put, you know, some, you know, to say. So I feel like that's just sort of the direction it always kind of went on its own. But at the same time, I think when I started doing any kind of writing in terms of, like, when I first wrote Laird Baylor, I didn't write it with the intention that anybody would ever see it. I mean, I think if you go into writing thinking anybody's ever going to read it, you'd never get a word out. Because the voices in your head, I mean, the nobody's going to like that, or people are going to be offended by this, or this isn't going to be right. Or, you know, there's just a thousand little voices up there that can stop you. So yeah, I think even with Laird Baylor, I didn't think anybody was ever going to read it. And then surprise, it got published. So
we've had a little chat about some of your influences, the genres that you have been influenced by and that you can't seem to escape, especially with your writing. And some of your academic background. As I said, as Summer and I found you through, yes, okay, it's two things. Yes, we first learned of you at the Comic-Con panel, but the reason I took more than a second glance, and this is no shade to any of the other authors, I have since read, I think, all four or five, however many novels are out available at the moment. I've read all of Cass Morgan's of that one series.
It's good stuff.
It's brilliant. And I haven't watched the TV show yet, but I've watched, I've listened. I've captured, all, of course, Debs. That's why we were there. And I have caught up with Cass's. But the reason we, and I mean this with all respect, gave you a second, third, fourth, and fifth glance was, like I said, the title of your forthcoming book and what it was about, the little tease you could give us. And so that brings us to, now we want to talk about Hag. We've got a little bit of background on you.
All
we
right.
want to talk to you about Hag. So I think you've already kind of given us a hint about how and why you felt not only you wanted to write something like Hag, but also you felt somewhat of a need to write mm-hmm. it, to bring this out of yourself before the some stories were lost.
Yep.
What year was it, or what day was it? If you remember, when did you decide, oh my gosh, okay, it's time. This is going to happen, and this is what it's going to look like.
It had been building for a while. It had been building, and I became the caretaker, if you will, of this very ancient book of family photographs. And a lot of them are kind of crumbling and they're falling apart, and I'm trying to figure out what to do with them even still. And in the midst of all of these photographs, and a lot of them, I mean, not a lot of them, but some of them go back clear to like the 1700s, and they're the old style photography where, you know, people had to sit there for like a good couple of hours, if not longer, for that picture to stick, right? And it's all of these old Scottish women, and it's kind of hilarious because they are just staring that camera down. They don't care that they have been probably sitting there for an hour, 2 hours, waiting for the picture to develop. They're staring this camera down. And then in the middle of this book of photos, I found what would have been the equivalent of a modern day business card for my great grandmother's, was a water diviner.
Ooh.
And psychic, an oracle and water diviner. Now, I have no evidence that she actually had the ability to find water or was a psychic, but it's this absolutely fascinating business card that this is what, you know, it's just kind of crammed into the middle of this book. And I saw this and I thought, well, dang, that's something, isn't it? Right? So I sat down and started writing pretty soon after that. And the story that opens up Hag, the story of Alice Grace nearly falling through the grate in Scotland, and being shoved back up out of the water and being saved from drowning. That really happened to my mother. And so I was just really, for a lot of the book, it was a pretty easy book to write because of if I ever got stuck, I could just go back and remember another wacky thing that had happened to my mother throughout her life and write it out, you know? So yeah, that story actually happened pretty true to the way it was recorded in the book. So it started with that, and I wrote that, and I sat on it for a little while, and then I just kind of kept going back and picking at it and picking at it. But it was interesting because the book itself was very different. In its first version, it was very, very different. It was the story of Alice Grace and her daughter, and then it stretched from, you know, her childhood into the future. And at one point I realized it wasn't working. It was just very, very broken. And it had no end. There was no way this book was ever going to end. It was going to be 5,000 pages. And it had no end. So I took a few days and I went up to a cabin in the woods. And I made sure that I didn't have any distractions. No internet, no anything. Just electricity and my laptop. And I cut about half the book. Like for writers, this is like the most painful part of the whole process. But I axed about 40,000 words. just and I didn't delete it. It's all sitting in a file somewhere because that's the. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's like the land of lost toys. Every writer's laptop, you know, you're like, I'm going to do something with that piece. So, I sat down and then I was left with, I needed to write another half of the book. And I was in this cabin and it was awesome and kind of scary all at the same time. I didn't get axe murdered. I think that was good.
Were you disappointed?
No, I have to say, I not that I wanted to get axe murdered, but I kind of think the threat would have been, you know, I was expecting a little bit more.
It would have given you more oomph as a writer.
Exactly, right? Think of the story I could have come back with. Yeah, scar or something. I don't know. A nick, you know, I don't know. But I had a dream that night of the Kaiich, and I had a dream of this. I had read the story of the Kaiich before, and it had been told. It had been one of the stories that my family had talked about when I was growing up. And I had this dream of the Kaiich, this ancient Scottish hag who lived in the lowlands and was rumored, of course, the way my family told them anyhow, was that she lived in the caves beneath the Scottish lowlands, and that the farmers would leave little offerings because if the crops went bad or if there was disease, and let's face it, the crops were always bad and there was always disease, that the Kaiich would be to blame, and it would be because you didn't leave an offering and you had displeased her in some way. But I had this nightmare of it, and I woke up the next day and I just started writing. And so I wrote the other half of the book. So then I spent the next couple of months after that kind of stitching the whole thing together. And weirdly, it worked. At least I hope it did.
Was it during that your time in the cabin when you realized, you know, you had to like do some major surgery on it? Is that when you also realized the format would be like alternating between the story of Alice Grace and splicing it or intersplicing it with the actual Kaiich?
It was about that time I realized it. And I didn't intersplice it at the time. I just wrote the Kaiich story. And then I went back and I thought, well, what do I do with this now? And then it was like surgery. It was like taking it and suturing it together. But it seemed to flow. And I think writing is weird like that, because a lot of times if you let it happen organically and then you go back to it, you realize that some part of you that maybe wasn't making a conscious decision knew what they were doing all along. And I felt like that with that book was, hey, these parts actually fit together. So cool.
Well, what I loved about the way that they kind of ran parallel was that the main story is, you know, the Alice Grace storyline. That's the present day. And we learned more about her as a person through her ancestors as they kept, you know, the next ancestor, and just following the line up to when it meets up with her current day. And I just loved the way that kind of filled in the blanks as it went. It was just a really interesting choice. And I don't think I've ever read a book that followed that kind of a pattern before. And it was just fascinating.
Oh, now I know who's writing my next bio. Awesome. Well, thank you. No, I feel like a lot of the stories that came out of her ancestors were stories that I'd kind of grown up with. And then there's a lot of fiction in there too. you know, that I was, sometimes I was just delighted that they were in a certain time in history and that things were happening. I was just really excited that they were in, that the book was in Glasgow during the spiritualism movement, because it was so big in Edinburgh and London, and you think about it in a lot of other places, but I think the spiritualism movement in particular kind of, I don't know, maybe I just had never thought of it as being that big in Scotland, but it was very prominent, and particularly in Edinburgh, but in all the big cities, it had a very big presence. And I was, so there were times when I was just really excited that things were happening in history at the same time that my characters would have been young women and would have been exposed to it. Same thing with the Scottish Women's Hospital too. I was really excited that I had a young character that would have been around during the inception of that. So yeah, so there's a lot of fiction in there, but a lot of times the stories were sort of intermingled with, oh, kind of a combination of fiction and fact.
Having spent a good amount of time in Scotland myself, I went to, I studied a year at the University of St. Andrews. I dated a Scot and he was from outside of Glasgow. So I spent a lot of time in and outside of Glasgow. But that was many years ago, talking about like this kind of a zigzag up and down, back and forth, you know, educational path, if you will. And we've been back to Scotland and specifically Glasgow a number of times over the past few years. And things have kind of started coming back as far as, you know, areas of town, places we like to go have dinner, you know, things that start to become your norm. So was there any inspiration as far as your placement of various locations or your placement or use of historical events? For example, was there really a TB outbreak around the time that you, that Catherine's mother, right? Or Catherine's grandmother?
Right.
Let loose over the city.
There was, fantastic. In fact. Yeah, there really was. There was a TB outbreak. But, you know, that wasn't that, unfortunately, that wasn't that hard to find during the time. And it wasn't maybe as devastating as I had it in my book, but there was definitely records of during that period in history of waves of TB that would kind of go in and wipe out whole neighborhoods. It was because TB was spread in such a communicative disease. I mean, it just would spread through whole tenements and entire neighborhoods until they got a grip on what was happening. And yeah, so there really was a spread, and it had hit, oh gosh, down like the wharf side of Glasgow. I mean, it had really wiped out like whole neighborhoods down there. So I kind of made it I exaggerated it perhaps a bit, but there, unfortunately at that.
And you are the god or the goddess of this universe, so.
I wiped out the whole city, but feel my wrath. you don't have to look hard in those times to find outbreaks of disease. And that was a really scary thing about the time, about just the nature of how stuff like TB traveled and the way that it was passed on to place, to person to person and family to family.
And was there something about a place or in or at Cathedral Court that historically had been found to be destroyed?
Well, that kind of came out of one of my family stories. And this one came from my grandmother, who talked about a big house in Cathedral Court that had been burned down. And when she was a little girl, that had been burned to the ground. But the only thing that was left standing was a big, gigantic tree. And I forget what kind of tree she even said it was, but she said that the house had burned basically around this tree, and this tree was just left completely unscathed. And how all the people, the locals, had all talked about how, well, it was haunted. That's why. It was the spirits that were protecting the tree, because there really wasn't any. I'm sure there is some kind of science reason why the tree didn't burn. But so if you take
silly
out science. Boring old science. If you take out that to the bystander and, you know, to the people that lived in that neighborhood, and Cathedral Court being as close to the necropolis as it was, there was a lot of superstition about spirits and places that were haunted, that Yeah, that was the story she told, was that this tree had been left standing after this manor house had just burned clean to the ground. And of course, the story went on from there. And you can never quite tell with a lot of old Scottish family stories where the truth stopped and then the story began. But of course, the story in the telling that I always heard went on to say that no one could ever build there again. The house was blighted, you know, put salt on the earth, you know, that it was just, ne'er did anyone step foot on the ground again. You know, it was very dramatic. And so, now, did that actually happen? It's probably like a Hilton now or something, you know, it's fine. But yeah, so that was the story. That was one of the stories that I grew up with, was the story about this big fire that destroyed this manor house, but then left, you know, the tree in the middle of a field.
So where did your inspiration for the rune tattoo come from? Because I'm not kidding. Like, third of the way through, I'm ready to go get one. So I'm not kidding.
I got
I'm
it.
Like, oh, you got one?
Yeah. I have.
Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Well, of course she has one. She wrote it.
Yeah.
She better have one.
Well, how, someone and I were talking about this. How do you pronounce it? Is it Ingvats or Ingwats?
Ingwaz. Okay. So I've been interested in runes for a long time. I don't know if they really tell, you know, the future. I like them, though. I like the idea that they do. You know, it's like you said, I'm a monster enthusiast. And I...
Yes.
I think it's actually a pretty apt pronunciation because I just really want them to work, like the molder of all things paranormal, because I just want them to work, right? I want to believe. But yeah, so I've been interested in runes for a long time, but Ingwaz is an interesting one because some runes are older than others. And the rune Waz, just W-A-Z, had existed in Celtic tradition long before the Vikings had really kind of landed in what was, you know, on the land that was Scotland at the time, and appropriated, if you will, a lot of the Celtic culture and took over the runes. So Ing is a Viking god. And so what they did was kind of come in and combine this to be Ingwaz, which is basically the idea of peace after a long war. And the Vikings attributed that peace to the god Ing. So Ing had finally brought peace after this long, bloody Viking war. But the Waz rune in that shape, because the original shape, the one that's on the cover of the book, is the more modern version of it. There's an older version of Ingwaz that's just, it's like a diamond that doesn't have the edges going out from it, if that makes any sense. So it had existed prior to the Viking appropriation of it. And I always thought that was kind of an interesting one. It's interesting too to me because runes generally, kind of like tarot cards, have a reverse. So if you draw them, they can mean something very different depending on the position that you draw them in. But Ingwaz isn't like that. And it's one of the very few runes that has no reverse position. So it always means the same thing. It's always the making whole of something that was broken, the bringing of peace, the promise of peace. And what's more, the promise of peace, even in times that look dark, that look terrible, that look like nothing will ever be right again. It's the idea that there's a completion to it and a reason why things are dark and terrible. It's because that peace is coming. And it will come. And so it's about hope. But I think it's interesting because there is no reverse position to that. No matter how you draw it, under what circumstances, it always means this. And I have the tattoo. And this is my first tattoo. And everybody scared me, by the way. They all said, when you get a tattoo on your wrist, it's the most painful place to get a tattoo.
Ignore them. They say that about everywhere you get one. Your foot is the worst.
Yeah, and this one actually, I think because I went in thinking it was going to be like, you know, worse than childbirth, like the worst pain in the world. And I was like, you're done already? And he was like, oh yeah, no, that was easy. And I'm like, oh, well, okay.
All right. Well, the next time I see you at Comic-Con, we're going to be tattoo twins.
Yes! Yes! I take that as a promise.
It's going to happen. Will. And I'm not kidding. Like, I'm not, like a third of the way through, I was like, how do I get one? I was like, I want one now. I want to be part of them. I want to be one.
Now, the question is, do you get it in black or do you get it in indigo?
Good question.
Well, so here's something kind of exciting. My mother hates tattoos. And when I told her I was going to do this, she was like, oh, what are you doing? This next step is joining a biker gang. I don't know what you're thinking. But then she saw it and she read the book and then she saw it in person and she was like, yeah, okay, I want to get one. So, well, at age 77, we're doing it. Like, fantastic. When next time she comes out to visit, I'm taking her to my guy. We're going in. And I was so excited because I thought that was it. And I was like, well, it was nice talking to you for the last 42 years. Sorry. I guess I'm out. But no, it's really fun. So yeah, it's really cool. And I have to say, I have zero regrets about it. And I feel like it's always been there. I feel like it has always been there and it's always been a part of me. And that's kind of a cool thing.
Well, that sounds like the tattoo is kind of just the final outward representation of reflective of the story of what eventually became the story of the hag, because as you said, you had your choice in reading genre, just the stuff that you already that you always liked as a kid. You had these family stories and all this stuff being dumped in your brain, right? That you grow up with, and then you went to school, and then you did this, and then you did that, and you started writing for a profession, and you decided to write hag, and as it developed and became what it ended up being, did you get the tattoo after it was, maybe not after it was published, but before it came out?
I did right before though. And I would have done it before, but it was a guy out here in LA named Daniel Winter who does this absolutely beautiful, like very fine line work. And yeah, he's really, really wonderful, but it takes like a year to get in with him.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really cool because I figured if I'm going to do this, I want to go. I'm going big. A friend of mine had work done by him, and she, you know, her stuff is absolutely gorgeous. And I was like, all right, well, no, I'm going to wait. It didn't quite take a year, but it took about 6 months to get in to see him. And he does all this really just absolutely gorgeous fine line work and really amazing stuff. So I wanted to go to somebody that. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure it's a simple enough design that I'm sure it's not incredibly, you know, it's not incredibly intricate, but I felt I like the delicacy of it, I guess.
Well, you also want to go to someone who has, I mean, if they have a 6 month to a year wait list, you know that you're going to someone who is renowned in some way. And you're trusting, mm-hmm. you want to trust someone with something that is, I mean, yeah, these days you can get surgery, you can get laser removal, but outside of that, you're getting something that's going to stay with you for the rest of your life. So you want someone that you trust and you know many others have trusted and continue to trust.
Well, and you're hoping for a little bit of magic. So you got to pick the right person to inscript you.
Right, exactly.
Exactly. And I think that where I was going is I don't think it was a coincidence that we saw you on that dais. I don't think it was a coincidence that you chose to go to someone whom you couldn't get into until September-ish, because just before your book came mm-hmm. out, it was like now being delivered to the world. So literally the outermost representation of this thing that had been brewing in your mind and in your heart and in your soul your entire life, and then you get, just before that is made available to the public, you get the outermost reflection or showing of this rune on your body. So I think that's actually synchronicity. I don't think it was meant to be any other way.
Nope. And I'm absolutely thrilled with it. It's funny though. Like, tattooing is funny because now I'm like, ooh, what else could I get? Ooh.
You got to write another book and make it mean something and then put it all over your body.
Right. And I thought about like Laird Bailer, but I'm like, I'm not sure I'd want that monster like permanently attached to me.
I mean, he's already in there, right? You already exercised him from your brain by writing him out.
That's true.
You don't want to invite that back.
Yikes, that'd be terrifying. But this rune is actually very peaceful. So I think if I write, you know, the next book coming up is about the devil. So I'm not sure that that's a good one to get a tattoo for either. But We'll see.
You kind of gave us our next segue, which is, what are some of your upcoming projects?
Oh, I can talk about everything. I'm not nearly so fancy that I have any secrets yet.
Yeah. We got her early.
I'll tell you everything. No, I have another book due out the same time next year, due out in October, called Davla, and it's in the editing stage right now. And I've actually sold two books of what is probably going to turn into a series in this line. But Davla is the Gaelic word for devil, and it's the story of the devil reborn in a little girl in 1980s era Los Angeles, stuck in the foster care system.
That's going to be difficult. Yeah.
Dark and mysterious, and I'm guessing tragic.
Well, I think one of the themes that I want to discuss, one of the things I hope is taken away from Davla, is the idea that people and our capacity for evil within ourselves is way scarier than any mythology that we could possibly come up with in any culture, because this isn't necessarily, we're not necessarily talking the Judeo-Christian devil, you know, capital D, but our capacity for cruelty and neglect and evil towards each other is way scarier than any mythology from any tradition. But, you know, the 1980s era, a lot of the book takes place in a really notorious group home that was here in Los Angeles and was only closed down somewhat recently, really, called McLaren Hall. And it was a dumping ground for kids who had emotional problems, physical problems, you know, who basically didn't fit in anywhere else in the foster care system. And it was shut down due to just absolute gross abuse and neglect of the wards in its state. So I set a lot of the book in that place, in that environment. And I'm not the only one. Janet Fitch, who's also an amazing person and author, her book White Oleander takes place partially in McLaren Hall. So I am not the first one to set horrific things happening, you know, in 1980s, 90s era Los Angeles in that particular setting. But it's one of those kind of blights on, I think, Los Angeles history, is the existence of that particular place. So I'm excited about it, though. And Davla is going to be good. And then I'm working right now on the second book in the series. And we'll see where it goes from there.
Series of what? Davla or series of Kayich?
Of devils. So, yeah, we'll see what happens.
Cool. And so you don't know where, you don't want to share where it's set yet, or will it be in the same place?
I don't know, really, to be honest. I'm in very early stages, and it carries the first book on past its point, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know enough about it to say anything about it yet.
What advice would you have for an aspiring writer?
Well, you know, I think writers all work so differently that I think it is really detrimental to your process to listen to anyone too much, or to try to take anyone's advice too much to heart. I just feel like writing is such an individual process. And I feel like writers tend to get very dogmatic about how they work and why it works for them and why you should do what they do. When in reality, I feel like it's so much anybody's game. I do think that you can't write with the intention that anybody's ever going to read anything that you write. I think you can't have an audience in mind when you write at all. I think when you do, you automatically start becoming an imitation of yourself. You start writing, you start editing yourself through the process. And in order to really get the good stuff out, you have to not worry about anything. You have to worry about not, you know, you can't worry about the moments when you're incorrect on something, or that you might offend someone, or that something might be too over the line, or too gory, or too scary, or too this, or too that. And you certainly can't worry about what genre it fits into, or who might be reading it. I feel like you just got to write it with the intention that nobody's ever going to see it. And, you know, Neil Gaiman talks about this. He talks about the idea that you can't ever write anything for money, because you'll end up kind of cheating yourself. You have to write it because it's something you truly feel passionate about. And And it's true, though. I mean, I feel like you can't do it because it's a job. You have to do it because it's a story that you would like to be, that you feel like needs to be out there. Hmm.
We've heard similar from Diana in that she says one of the best ways that one of the two most important things you can do is read and read everything and write for no one. Write just to get it out. And then in her very oft told origin story of how Outlander began, she was doing a novel for practice. And it was something no one else was going to see. So great minds think alike. Since it sounds like, is it Davla you said?
Davla.
Since it sounds like Davla has the fantasy elements.
Oh, yeah. Definitely magical and fantasy elements.
Okay. It could also interest especially our All Souls family. So yeah, let's definitely keep in touch, and we'd love to have you back.
Well, I would love to be back. This was so much fun. Thank you. And I have to admit, though, after listening to your podcast, I'm having trouble not calling Summer Shimmer. So,
oh Lord, what did you listen to?
She clearly listened to in the last.
Oh my sorry, God.
No, it's amazing.
Don't be sorry, it's amazing. It's yeah. I checked Twitter today or today. It must have been today. Anyway, ever since that came out, and to be fair, I posted it everywhere. But ever since that came out we mentioned it on our show. I think two episodes ago, and it's like the thing that now it just won't die. And I think it's great that it doesn't die because I find it hysterical. But someone replied to some tweet we had, like we schedule a lot of tweets because. Again, full-time day jobs, right. Commutes, blah, blah, blah. So I try and do like a lot of front loading. So the rest of the week, it's, you know, a little bit easier. And so I schedule some tweet that was a promotional tweet for, I think, our latest episode. Anyway, I was checking our notifications today and what was it? It was something. It was very short. And it was
they just said they were Team Shimmer. Like, they were Team Shimmer.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And I was like, what?
Nice.
I was like, okay, I know what that means, but like what specifically? Because Shimmer and I talked about a lot of stuff.
it doesn't matter. Just always
that's
be Team
so
Shimmer.
Perfect. That's so perfect that you just said Shimmer. That makes my day. Amazing. Oh yeah. My gosh.
That was awesome.
Yeah. No, I'm just having trouble.
Pressure.
So, you know,
don't have trouble. Oh, just say it. Just, you know, just be
embrace it.
Exactly. Which is why when she said it, I was like, let's just do it.
Yeah.
I've only had this name for umpteen many years. I can just switch it.
Right.
It's fine.
Exactly. It's
but
all
now
good.
My phone,
you know?
Like autocorrects to Shimmer. I mean, I can't ever since it did it and then it went and then I had to delete it. My phone goes, I do Summer and it goes Shimmer. And then if it doesn't do Shimmer, it does Simmer. And like, no, I want Summer.
Well, it was like today when I was trying to write the word ducking for real this time. And I had to explain that I was actually trying to use ducking and I wasn't trying to curse. Because usually when I try to curse, it changes it to ducking.
Ducking, yeah. Everyone with an iPhone knows that.
Oh, yeah. And I've sent some absolutely absurd emails to relatively important people because I sent them on my phone and it changed it to things like Shimmer ducking, you know, fart balls. And I was like, really? That's not seriously? Because I type those things so often. I can totally see why you would put that out there.
Well, and that's the scary thing is like this email, I don't even know who it was to. It may have been to our, it was not to a sponsor because we don't communicate with sponsors. We have our media host does that. They're kind of like the in-between. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was our media host. It was either a media host or
I'm not going to lie. I'm really hoping that it was actually an email you were sending to Kathleen because that would have made this full circle for me.
Oh, I don't think it was, but it could have been. Like I said, I corrected it. So the person
I'm
going to
go
out.
Back and look.
Oh, God. No, it never sent.
She stopped it before it went, but.
Oh, Lord. I saw it and corrected it before, but I was like, I need to take a screenshot because this is pretty amazing.
Never correct it again if you're sending it to me. Never.
Oh, Lord.
She won't know who you're talking about if you say Summer.
I'll try. That's true. Who's Summer?
Just send every ducking word, okay?
Every ducking word. You get them all.
Oh, my goodness. No, but that's kind of nice and a little freaky. I mean, it's a free world and it's out there, so it's meant to be listened to. So I don't know why it surprises me, but it still surprises me that people listen. Isn't that silly? I mean, we do it for the purpose. But then when someone mm-hmm. says, oh, I heard that, I'm like, you, oh my God, you listened?
You were the one? I know. Every time anybody has ever mentioned that they've read any of my books, I've been like, really? Where'd you find it? Did you talk to my mom or something? What? That's weird.
It is weird. It is definitely weird. It's amazing, but it can be mm-hmm. it can be a little uncomfortable. It's always positive, pretty much positive, but oh yeah, it can be like, oh God, they heard me say I don't know what, because we've only done 275, so who knows what they heard, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was laughing because I have a Goodreads review right now of my very first book, and the guy was so it reads like he was so angry he can't even speak right now. I mean, he's really pissed. And I almost kind of want to meet him to be like, wow. Wow. I don't think I ever felt that strongly about that book. I really want to talk. Oh, you know, isn't that kind of funny?
Can I talk you down? What happened? How did I hurt you?
Wow. Yeah. So I'm like, how'd you even find it? That's cool.
Well, why did you find it? How did you find it? And why did you keep reading?
Exactly.
You were that upset.
Why? Right. He was rage reading at one point.
Me out. Oh, he was. I learned that term from Summer, from Shimmer.
I have so many questions. Just so many questions for him. I just have a feeling that it's not my contacting him wouldn't help. Very angry.
He's like, well, not you again.
We have gone. Whoa. You have been so generous with your time. We apologize for going over, but it just means, at least on our side, that we've had way too many oodles of fun, and we really enjoyed speaking with you. And we, as I said, we hope to have you back, talk about something other fantastical and magical. And on the blog post on both sites that features this interview, we will have, of course, your headshot. We'll give a shot of the book. And we can include and your bio. What's the best practice, or what is the best synopsis that we could include? Is it the one from the book?
The one on the book is probably the best.
Okay, perfect. So we'll include that and
awesome.
Everything in there. And also, we want to give people a chance to, and we'll include your website, everything like that. But what kind of information? How would someone get a hold of you? What's the best way?
They can contact me through the website. If they go through the website, it reaches me directly. So,
okay, perfect.
Yeah, if they just do the contact form through that, it gets to me. So that's actually perfect. In all places, you can see really great pictures of what I had for dinner, my dog, you know.
Excellent. Thank you so much for chatting with us, being so gracious with your time, because I know it's a weeknight and and we definitely went overboard. But
this is fun.
It was all fun.
This is really fun.
It was all on topic in some manner and
a roundabout way.
Fantastic. And I am going to do cross my fingers, toes, eyeballs, ankles, knees, legs, not knees, legs, oh, whatever. Yeah. All the things you can cross.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yep. My gosh. And say a prayer and light candles. I don't care. Whatever it is to make.
Yep.
Oh, man, that Kaiich needs the hag. Sorry. The hag needs to be option. Holy doodle squirts. Oh, Lord.
Wow, dude. That was.
Well, they're working on
pulled
it.
Pulled out a doodle squirt for her.
Good. Oh, that makes me happy. You don't even
so
know.
Actually, you probably do know.
it's kind of your baby. So, of course, it's meaningful to you.
Yeah, no, I they're working on it. So again, yay! Like I don't have anything, you know, it's so far outside of my, it's like you have a child and they've left the house now.
Exactly. But the reason I'm so excited is because it's like, it's entered your mind. You know what I'm saying? It's something mm-hmm. that you're not opposed to. That's what I'm saying.
Oh yeah. Oh no, it's cool. And there's a ton of really female heavy studios out there right now.
Oh yeah.
You know, and I think it's a great time politically and artistically for something like this that's really very female centric, and I think it's really cool time for it. So I think if it was ever going to have a good shot at it, I think this is when it would happen.
It's the fantasy response to the dystopian Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah, I like that.
I like it too.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
You've
been so generous. So we can't wait to have you back. And thank you. I'm just like muttering and not stopping here. So thank you so much, Kathleen,
for
for chatting with us here at the Outlander podcast, and the All Souls podcast. You got a two. We all got a twofer. That's pretty good. Woo! And we will be in touch, hopefully, very soon. We can't wait to have you back.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
For us, too. Yay!
Woohoo!
Okay, thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.